This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB Online.org. MPB Think Radio.
From MPB Think Radio, it's Creature Comforts, the show all about your animals and the animals around you. I'm Kevin Farrell with Dr. Troy Major from the Animal Medical Center in Jackson and Libby Hartfield, director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. We're always happy to answer questions about your pets, and today we're also talking about spiders with museum volunteer John Davis. Call us at 1-877-MPB-RING, which is 877-672-7464, or email a question to animals@mpbonline.org. You're listening to Creature Comforts from MPB Think Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell with Libby Hartfield, the director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science, Dr. Troy Major, the veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson. Our guest this morning, John Davis, a Museum of Natural Science volunteer and retired science educator. And if you're a frequent listener to Creature Comforts, you know John's been with us several times, always has some very interesting stories to share. John, thanks again for joining us.
Arachnophobes beware. Halloween spiders today.
That's right. We'll be talking about spiders, also taking your pet questions today. Call us at 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464 if you have a question for us this morning. We've already got one caller on the line, but we're going to hold on that for just a few minutes. A couple of reminders that I'd like to point out. First of all, tonight at 7, there's a special version of Southern Remedy on both MPB Think Radio and MPB Television. Tonight at 7, there'll be a special about swine flu hosted by our very own Dr. Rick DeShazo. It's a question and answer thing with a panel discussion as well, so a chance for you to get your questions answered about swine flu. Again, that's tonight at 7 on MPB Radio and Television. And also, Libby, we'd like to remind folks of what's going on at the museum. Let's go start with the slither, crawl, fly. That's a special Halloween thing that y'all have going on.
Yeah, this coming Saturday, I think everybody knows it's Halloween, at 10 a.m., 10 o'clock Saturday morning, we're doing slither, crawl, fly. And it's where you learn the truth about all those spooky things that we use on Halloween, the snakes and the spiders and the bats, and lots of fun things you can go take back to school and home to your parents to kind of gross them out, maybe.
All right.
Yeah. Lots of fun.
Heaven
you can
forbid
come
any
your,
child would want to gross out their parents.
You can come in your costume, and if you families have not discovered that the museum's a fun place on Saturday and Sunday afternoon, come on down. You know, we've been really busy these rainy weekends.
Okay. There is another lecture coming up in early November.
Yes, Tuesday. This coming Tuesday, October, let's see, what day is that? No, November the 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
Dina Dickerson's going to talk about protecting sea turtles. And sea turtles are always an interesting topic anyway. And she's going to talk about I guess basically that how we all have to live together, what we've learned in the last 25 years about how to protect sea turtles and still have them living in the shipping lanes. And we know we've got to dredge to keep shipping lanes open. And there's just a lot of little tricks that people have learned so that the turtles can stay there and we can also have commerce in those areas. You know, coastal areas are so busy. We think of it recreationally, but there's a whole lot of business going on in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an inexpensive way to move freight. It's much cheaper to put something on a barge or a boat and send it down a river or across a intercoastal canal, but we've got to learn how to protect wildlife while we do that.
And Monsters of the Deep, I think, are still at the museum.
Yeah, we've passed the 60,000 mark. We've had over 60,000 visitors now for Monsters of the Deep. And It'll be there through the holiday season, so okay. That's something to remember if you've got out-of-town guests coming.
And again, that's life-size skeletons and models of some of the monsters of the deep from the oceans, but not only in present day, but also in past time as well.
Right, yeah, it's a good mixture of what lives in the ocean today and what we know lived in the oceans in the past.
We have got some phone lines lighting up here, so why don't we go ahead and take some phone calls here today on Creature Comforts. Let's start out with a call from Sandersville. Karen's on the line. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, I have a six-toed cat, and she's had kittens, and I know they're supposed to have six toes on the front, but I'm kind of curious of how rare it is to have six toes on the front and the back.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. I guess the correct term is polydactylism, which sounds more like a prehistoric bird or something like that.
Okay.
But actually, it is uncommon, but we do see it. And the most I've seen, basically, a cat is supposed to have four and a dew claw. Okay, so
yeah.
They have four claws and a dew claw. That's on the front, and then there are four on the back. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So you have a cat that has six on the back as well as the front.
Yes, I have two kittens
okay.
out of her that
right.
has them on the front and the back.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe the Hemingway cats down in Key West were polydactyl cats. I think that's correct.
Yes.
So it you may have some related to the Hemingway cats. I'm not sure, but we do see it occasionally, and it's really quite interesting. I compare it to a catcher's mitt almost on these cat's hand. Usually it does not cause any problem. Watch on these kittens. Sometimes it's misdirected. As the claws grow, it may grow into the other toe. So kind of watch those because sometimes they are not able. You know, cats claw to do what? They shed their claws and sharpen them in the meantime, but and aggravate you if they're on the couch or sofa. But just watch that because sometimes they do grow in because of some, the mass of claws there and the mass of toes. So, but that's interesting, and it does occur, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I have another quick question, if you can
yes.
take it.
Go ahead.
Okay, I have a chinchilla.
Yes, ma'am.
And they're supposed to be cool at all times so they don't have heat strokes.
Okay.
All right, with winter coming on, you know, you can't put them outside. They have to be in the house. How do I keep it cool during the wintertime? Because I have the heat on in the house.
I'd pick the coolest room in the house. Do you have a cage or a place for it?
Yes, it's got its own cage and a little sleeping area and everything.
I would pick the coolest room in the house. The chinchilla is healthy and doing good.
Oh, very.
Good, good.
It's begging for treats right now.
Right. They do make good pets, and we don't see many anymore, of course. Back before the days of the emu and ostrich boom and others, there was a chinchilla boom, probably back in the 60s or maybe even earlier. And you saw people that they didn't have air conditioning in the house, but they had this little block building out behind the house with air conditioner for the chinchillas. But that went bust as well, just like a lot of the other pyramids and booms that occur. But, yes, I would pick a cooler area of the house and let that be for the wintertime when the house is warmer.
All right, Karen, we appreciate your call today on Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're going to be talking about spiders as well as take pet questions this morning. If you have a comment or something that you'd like to share with us, 877-MPB-RING. It's 877-672-7464. We had a listener call in, Libby, that wanted a progress report. Last week you mentioned that you had helped kind of rescue an eagle that had someone had called in and seen. And why don't you, if you can, give us any more information you have on that.
I'm trying to think of where we were with it on Thursday. I think not very far along. The eagle was doing well the last I checked. In fact, I've got that on my list to call again today. But Pat and Bob Lawrence, who are the eagle rehabbers, do a great job. And they took the eagle, you know, I think I'd said it was x-rayed. Mm-hmm. We found that both the legs were broken.
Right.
So it went to LSU Vet mm-hmm. School, which has a state-of-the-art facility for birds of prey. And, you know, when you think about it, those leg bones are hollow. That makes it very hard to heal. It's got to be aligned just really perfectly before an eagle's bones will heal. So they put pins and very thin little metal plates. One of the legs was more serious, and so it's got the metal plates, and both the legs have the pins, and it was a pretty good prognosis. They were hoping, which you always try for, I guess, is for it to be releasable again. And mm-hmm. so as far as I know, okay. And then the Lawrences had a second bird last week that also went to LSU, an older bird that was a white-headed eagle. So it's, you know, we have over 70 eagle territories now that we know about that we're monitoring, so I'm sure there are more. And when you have a lot of eagles, I guess you get some eagle injuries.
Libby, I had a question. It's kind of strange that both legs would be broken on that bird. Any ideas of what might have happened?
You know, we don't know what happened, and the Lawrences were confused too. You know, ordinarily, if a bird was going to fly close to a branch or a power line or something, the legs would be pulled up closer to the body. So I don't know at all. I was thinking you might know more than I did about what might happen.
I guess he could have gotten hung in something, you know, and then snapped his legs. That's kind of a weird way to have that happen, though.
But for the wings to be injury-free, didn't that seem strange?
Yes. Explain, too, what a white-headed eagle versus a...
Oh, okay. We always think about a bald eagle being white-headed, but they don't get that white head until they're about 4 years old. Mm-hmm. So a young bald eagle might look like a golden eagle. One of the things we teach the children is if you look at those legs, a bald eagle's preferred food is fish. So they like their tend to be around water, and they wear short pants. So the unfeathered part of the leg goes up much higher. And then a golden eagle who lives not so close to water usually, and their prey are rabbits and rats and things, the feathers go all the way down, and the feathers will be right down by the toes. Mm-hmm. So that's an easy way to look and see if you're in an area that might have both. But so it'll be an immature eagle, and sometimes people will be confused and say, well, you know, it wasn't a bald eagle because it didn't have that white head, but it's just a younger bald eagle.
All right, and if you could, we'd be interested in kind of following that story, so hopefully we can get some updates on Thursdays as to the progress of the eagle there as he or she recuperates at LSU. We're on Creature Comforts today talking about spiders and also answering your pet questions. John Davis, a museum volunteer, is with us. John, we've got a spider question on the line, so let's invite Robert from Natchez into the conversation. Robert, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a problem with an area near one of my entrances to my home where I know there are black widows, and there are many other spiders also. Well, I appreciate the spiders taking care of as many of the mosquitoes as they can, and I really hate to exterminate right there where I need them. So that's the one. And then second, we always hear about the brown recluse and the black widows and the dangers that they pose in biting us. I'd like to know about other spiders that are maybe not as poisonous that we should be concerned about, you know, like the orb weavers and the brown wolf spiders and such. Will they bite? And if so, how dangerous is it?
Well, let me answer your second question first. All spiders, except a fascinating family called the spitting spiders that spit silk on their victims, have some venom. But of the 40,000 or so species that have been named, only 50 have been shown to be in any way dangerous to human beings. Now, the other spiders you mentioned are sometimes able to break the skin with their chelicerae, the big wolf spiders and so on and so forth. And large orb weavers like the golden silk spider can do the same. The bites, however, very rarely have any effect at all, or if they do, it is much less than a bee sting. In this part of the world, unlike, say, Australia, where everybody knows the fauna is fierce and everything wants to get you, but in this part of the world, you really have to worry about the several species of widows we have and the brown recluse spider. If you are bitten by a big spider like a wolf spider, and of course, all spiders only bite defensively, you might want to, in some cases, get a tetanus shot or something of that sort, but that is about all. Now, as to your question about spider control, chemicals are almost completely ineffective. Pesticides have almost no effect at all other than discouraging insects. And the way to deal with spiders where you don't want them essentially is house hygiene. Your best weapon is a vacuum sweeper. You can vacuum up the webs. You can vacuum up the spiders. They are soft-bodied, and the vacuum sweeper will almost certainly smush them. Be very careful about bringing furniture in from storage or from the country, because that's how the brown recluse usually gets into your house.
All right. We'll pause right there for a break. Robert, thanks for your call this morning. We'll learn more about spiders from John Davis after this break. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Radio. Spiders and pets are topics today. 877-MPB-RING is our phone number, which is 877-672-7464. Back with more after this.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.
Welcome back to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell with Libby Hartfield, the director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science, Dr. Troy Major, a veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and our guest helping us learn more about spiders this morning, John Davis, a retired science educator and a volunteer at the museum. John, before we went to break, you were telling us a little bit about spider control and was saying that sometimes your vacuum cleaner might be the best weapon.
We had a very intelligent caller who made the point that he might not want to wipe out the spiders since they are extremely useful in insect controls, and there are some insects in this West Nile area that can really hurt you. On the other hand, you certainly don't want to expose yourself to the bites of the very few dangerous species like our several species of widows and the brown recluse. We mentioned, yes, that house hygiene is the basis of it. Chemical control, pesticides simply don't work. So vacuum sweepers do a very good job of getting rid of unwanted spiders and unwanted webs and does them in at the same time. Be very careful about furniture coming into the house. Look for egg masses, little round brown or yellow tufts. A nasty spider that's been moving into our area is the so-called brown widow. We'll talk about it later, but its egg mass is nibbly. It looks like a little sand burr. Brown recluse egg masses look yellow and papery, and so on and so forth. Often, though, you can just move a nice spider, and most are, around with a little gentle persuasion with a broom. And if you don't want to risk being bitten by one of the widows, wear gloves. People who are bitten are almost always cleaning out a storage area, doing something of that sort. Be very careful around wood piles. Wear gloves. The widows, the several species we have, stay in low, dark places. The brown recluse are another sort of problem because of their unfortunate habit of getting out and wandering about at night and sometimes winding up in bedclothes and things of that sort. They're not after your blood, but if pressed against the skin, they may very well bite. Now, the little brown spiders hanging upside down in tangled webs, house spiders, are not brown recluse. Brown recluse make low, again, in corners on the ground, shapeless webs. They vary in color from a sort of yellowish brown to a grayish brown. They're about the size of a quarter. They have the notorious fiddle mark on the back. And if you like to look at spiders' faces with magnifying glasses, that's not for the timid. But if you smush a spider and want to know, you can immediately tell it's a brown recluse because it has six eyes arranged around in a circle, glaring at you. Most spiders have eight. They are not the little spiders that hang up, brown spiders that hang upside down on the webs. In fact, they scamper around very quickly, very quickly. But again, go after them with a vacuum sweeper and keep them out.
John, I have a question, and maybe I'm wrong, but do the brown recluse or do spiders shed their shells?
Yeah.
And that sometimes is a tip-off for people that they might have brown recluse if they see the shells in a area and could identify by the shell.
Well, yes, the cast exoskeleton is different from the house spider. House spiders are tangled web spiders. They have a little round abdomen like a pea. These guys have elongated abdomens that, again, are about the size of a quarter. You can find their exoskeletons. That's certainly true. Now, there is another spider to worry about in the Pacific Northwest called the so-called hobo spider. Like so many animals today, it's moved around. It's come in from Europe. There's some evidence that it can have a venomous bite, although much less unpleasant than the brown recluse spider. It belongs to the sac spider group, and it is moving around, as critters tend to do. None have been found in this area in Mississippi, but I suspect it will be with us soon. But again, these guys give a wonderful group of animals a bad name.
We're on Creature Comforts today, talking with John Davis, a museum volunteer, about spiders and also answering some pet questions. If you'd like to join in our conversation, the number is 877-MPB-RING, which is 877-672-7464. Robbie has called in from Mobile. Robbie, what's your question this morning?
Good morning. We recently lost our border collie. And I found that living with a border collie was living with one of the most intelligent animals that I've ever known in my entire life. We were getting ready to retire, and our other dog weighed about 45 pounds. And he's a little on the chubby side because we like to feed him off the table sometimes. But in getting ready to retire, I've heard about miniature border collies. And I cannot find any information on the Internet. And I'm wondering if there even is such a thing as a miniature border collie. And if there is, how do I go about contacting a breeder? I've even checked with the AKC here in Mobile, and I haven't gotten a good response about that. Now, that's one thing, and I want to make a comment real quick on the eagle thing. We live 5 miles from Big Creek Lake here in Mobile, which is Mobile's water supply, and we have seen eagles in our yard. So they're getting to be more and more eagles in the southeast, so it's something to look forward to.
Yeah,
very good. I will second the border collie thing as far as their intelligence. One of the biggest problems that we run into with the herding type dogs is they get bored if they're at home for 10, 12 hours a day, and they can get into trouble sometime because of that. But they are very smart, and appreciate your comments about that. Most breeds, it seems like in the last decade, most breeds, some breeders have identified themselves or identified smaller versions of larger breeds. I haven't seen anybody that said they had a miniature Rottweiler, but at the same time, there are miniature dachshunds, of course, that's recognized. But I would continue to check if there's a listener or somebody that's listening, certainly they could call and give us some information about how to locate the miniature border collies. As a veterinarian, I have not seen the miniature border collie, though. Good luck in your search, and if somebody would like to call in if they know of some, certainly, we'll be glad to take that message or email us here at
animals.mpbonline.org is our email address. That's one thing I like about the show is that we throw some of these things out, and we've got great listeners that'll call in or send in some information. So, again, if you know anything about some miniature border collies, either call us or email us animals@mpbonline.org, and we'll see if Robbie can get some information he's looking for. We are on Creature Comforts today, taking pet questions as we do each week, but also talking with John Davis about spiders. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 877-MPB-RING. 877-672-7464. Let's go to Gulfport and invite Tim into the conversation. Tim, you've got some suggestions for getting rid of spider webs. Go ahead.
Yes, I studied spiders up in the Delta for about 12 years, and we used to rear them in the lab, and my technicians were never thrilled when we had to clean up the cages because they always had to get rid of the webs. Not fun for a lot of people.
Yes.
And one day I was cooking some Chinese food, and was sprinkling some MSG into the meal, and realized that MSG was a denatured protein. So the next time we had to clean up the cages, I mixed some MSG up in some water in a little spray tank and sprayed the inside of the cages, and all the webs dissolved.
Wow.
Good Lord.
Wow.
Which makes one wonder what that Chinese restaurant is doing to you. Goodness.
Yes. Well, I've been cooking Chinese food for over 40 years, and all I am now is about 100 kilos. So.
That's right. Gets rid of all that unwanted stuff. Very good.
By the way, there is one other spider here in Mississippi that is potentially dangerous, and it is a sac spider. It's called Chiracanthium inclusum. I don't even think it has a common name.
Yeah.
I'm probably the only person in the States that's been bitten by one. But they're actually more dangerous than the widow spiders. Not as much as the recluse, but their venom is more powerful than the widow's.
Is it a neurotoxin or a hemotoxin?
It's both. You know, there's three in it. There's a cytotoxin, hemotoxin, and neurotoxin.
Yeah.
And the cytotoxin causes more damage with the brown recluse.
Yes.
Whereas with the widows, it's more of a neurotoxin.
Uh-huh.
But this sac spider, its venom has a higher neurotoxin level, but not quite as high a cytotoxin level.
Is it a yellowish-brown nondescript spider, or what's it?
Yes, it's nondescript, and it's a nocturnal wanderer. And they spend the day curled up in leaves.
Uh-huh.
They roll a leaf up and spin. That's why they call it a sac spider. They spend the day inside that curled up leaf. And I used to run across them quite a bit in untreated soybean and cotton fields.
Do they enter houses?
They have on occasion, but they're primarily a problem with gardeners.
Okay, well, thank you. That's extremely...
So people will see a curled up leaf and decide to pop it off the plant for some reason, thinking it's diseased or whatever, and may have one of these little sac spiders in it, and they can do a bit of damage. And the problem is, like the recluse, is you don't initially feel the bite.
Mm. Yes, I know several people who have been bitten by recluses in their sleep and are really unaware of this for some time. Well, thank you. That's very useful information.
Okay.
Tim, before you go, thanks for calling.
Yeah.
If you'll email us a contact and phone number, we would love to talk to you later about fire ants, too. I know Tim knows an awful lot about fire ants as well as spiders.
All right.
Oh, sure. I'll contact you through the museum or through
the... Yeah, either one. Yeah, the museum or MPB. Yeah.
Oh, and I have another question for you.
Sure.
Did the spiders turn out to have a valuable or important role in the fields you were studying?
Oh, yes, they are. I co-authored an article many years ago in the Annual Review of Entomology on the value of spiders in agroecosystems. In and of themselves, of course, they can't do the job, but they are certainly a valuable part of a cost-free benefit. I mean, they'll feed on anything out there that they can grab a hold of not bigger than them, and I've even seen them attack things bigger than them. And by the way, spiders are pretty good to eat, too. It tastes kind of like buttered pecans.
If I may make an aside, this is the where the Little Miss Muffet story came from. We'll tell it later.
All right, Tim, thanks for your call this morning. Butter pecan ice cream sounds a lot better than spider ice cream to me. Maybe that's just me. Who knows? It might taste really well. We're going to take a break. We're talking about spiders with John Davis, a museum volunteer, taking pet questions as well. Dr. Major's with us today. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Back after this.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.
Welcome back. This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell with Libby Hartfield and Dr. Troy Major. Our guest this morning is John Davis, and we're talking about spiders and also answering some pet questions. I always enjoy having John on the air with us on Creature Comforts. He's always got such interesting and amazing stories. And John, you were going to tell us the story of Little Miss Muffet.
Little Miss Muffet and her tuffet. There was a Dr. Muffet in the 17th century. back at the beginnings of what we think of as science, who was very interested in spiders and, among other things, believed they had great medicinal value, and he was always concocting spider recipes and feeding them to his daughter. Her curds and whey were laced with spiders. Well, the young lady was not terribly happy about this. did some writing of her own, and that's where our beloved nursery rhyme comes from. Actually, Dr. Muffet was pretty sharp. He distinguished spiders from insects sharply, but I don't think that mattered too much to poor little Miss Muffet.
All right. Now, also, you always have some interesting questions on our question list, and so let me get to a couple of these. It's why did they cross a goat with a spider?
Okay. Not to make a horror movie or to get an eight-legged goat, but to get the proteins in spider silk to make a great variety of things and for medicinal purpose. Spider silk is marvelous stuff. Some of it 6 times stronger than steel and friendly to the human body, so it can be used internally. It can be made into bulletproof vests stronger than Kevlar. It has all sorts of marvelous potential uses, but the problem is milking the spider. Now, as far back as the French Revolution, there were people with ideas for making ladies' stockings out of spider silk because it's such a durable stuff. But with the genetic engineering wizards have succeeded in inserting genes from our own golden silk spider, the guy that makes those tremendous strong webs which you whang into and can't break out on your favorite nature trail, into the genome of a goat, and you get the proteins in the milk. And a considerable industry is developing. For one thing, it can be used in more successfully for neurosurgery and growing new nerve cells in any product which has ever been found. So that particular spider industry is taking off.
Very good. We've got some spider questions lined up on the phone, so we'll go to the phones. Let's go first to Dan from Tupelo. Dan, go ahead, please.
I've always been curious about bioluminescence and anywhere in nature, but
yeah.
Many years ago, Forrester from Natchez was involved in some training down at Camp Hood. He took us for a walk in the woods after supper and parted some vines at the base of a pine tree, and there was a bioluminescent spider that he showed us, and I wondered if you could describe that and tell me how you could recognize it in a more lighted condition.
I am absolutely fascinated to hear this. I have never in all the literature run into a bioluminescent spider. Was it in a web?
I couldn't tell. It was dark. We turned off all our flashlights.
Oh, I think I know what you saw. You saw the glowing eyes of wolf spiders. If you go out at night with a miner's lamp and look down in the grass, when small wolf spiders and other hunting spiders, one of the many groups of spiders that use silk but don't make webs, you will see little pinpoints of red light. These spiders have are essentially visual in their hunting. They have rather well developed eyes, and think of a cat's eyes in the dark when you shine a light. These spiders do have a tapetum, a layer of material which reflects light when light strikes the eye. So it's a very eerie sight when you go out with a miner's lamp or something of the sort and see all these little moving pinpoints of light. I am reasonably sure that that's what you saw.
All right, Dan, thanks for your call today on Creature Comforts. Let's keep up on the phones here. A call from Clinton, and you're on the line. Next up, go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Morning.
I want to know about a spider that greets me at my front door. I want to know about two spiders, but this is the first one. It is a little bitty spider, not much bigger than your little fingernail, and it's black, and it's got a white dot on it, and it jumps.
Oh, those are some of the most delightful animals in the world. They're called jumping spiders. They use silk for drag lines and to make retreats and wrap their eggs, but they don't have webs. They remind me of crosses between cats and hummingbirds. They hunt like cats. They hunt visually. And they're often brightly colored like hummingbirds. One of these turns out to have an IQ in the sense of being able to remember things, find alternative ways to get to its prey and solve problems, as high as a vertebrate. Right now, neuroscientists are very interested in Portia, which is a spider-eating jumping spider in Australia, which with a tiny brain solves all these learning problems in another way. Think of it, a mind with eight legs. But that little spider really does greet you and probably recognize you. If you look at a jumping spider's face, they have two great big headlamp-type eyes right in the middle, and their vision is remarkably good, the best of that of any invertebrate animals, better than a squid's. You see it, it sees you. And they do. They make delightful pets. What's the other question?
All right, hang on. Ann?
Spread it out, it'd be about the size of a half a dollar.
Okay,
and it was in boxes with, you know, that we were cleaning out.
Uh-huh.
And I just happened to see it and stopped my son from grabbing where he was fixing to grab. Now, I did spray it until it did die, and I'm sorry to say that, but I didn't know what it was, and I didn't want to injure either one of us.
Well, it could be many, many things. Of that particular size, it might well have been a wolf spider, if it was that large. These two are hunting spiders without such good vision. By the way, they're excellent mothers. Sometimes you see them with their babies on their backs. I really can't answer on the back of that. But as you describe it, it is too large to be a brown recluse. Now, widow-type spiders are shiny and have long legs and have P-shaped bellies, and so it doesn't sound like that. The best bet, I would say, would be one of the wolf spiders. And by the way, that was a very rude spider. Don't apologize for protecting yourself.
All right. Ann, thanks for your call today on Creature Comforts. We're jammed up on the phone line, so let's continue to get some spider questions. To Henleyfield we go. Mike, you're on the line. Want to talk about the sack spider. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling in to say that I have some experience with the yellow sack spider down here in Pearl River County.
A characanthum? Yeah. And what happened?
I was bitten by one. I'm pretty sure it was. Like you said, you don't feel it. It was in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some necrosis, but it was small and it healed up fairly quickly. And then I started noticing them. They do come inside, and they will also make a sack inside.
Yes.
In between, in tight spaces. And they're pretty aggressive hunters. You see them on the wall and ceilings at night.
Yeah, that sounds very much like the hobo spider of the Pacific Northwest, and indeed it may have made it to this particular area. Even people who are bitten by the brown recluse usually get over the problem, have the lesion heal after a couple of weeks, although the results can sometimes be quite nasty and even take tissue grafts. But thank you for that information. We'll keep a lookout for them.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call today on Creature Comforts. Again, we're going to go head right back to the phones. Sally Lodge has called in from Gulfport. Go ahead for us.
What are the spiders that are on my banana plants in the summertime? They're big and they're gorgeous looking and they're terrifying looking. Are those dangerous?
Well, do they spin webs?
Yes.
Do they spin big wheel-like webs?
I don't remember, but they do have webbage, and it is striking.
Okay. Now, if they're very large, they could be one of two things. They could be the one we talked about, the golden silk spider. The golden silk, however, tends to stay in forested areas across trails. Are your banana plants in an open area?
Yes.
Okay, that's almost certainly an argiope, the yellow garden spider. Does the web, I want you to visualize it now, look like it like it has a kind of Z of thicker silk down the middle?
It might, and I think there's some yellow on the spider. I remember thinking they were striking as I ran away from it.
Well, they are at extreme. extraordinarily beautiful animal, and they mean you no ill will whatsoever. If you grabbed one and started to pull its legs off, I suspect it might give you a little pinch, but it would be much, much less than the effect of a bee sting. That's, if you'd like to look it up on the web, is Argiope aurantia, the yellow garden spider, and it is one of our larger and more spectacular beasts.
And if it makes you feel better about it, that's the Charlotte's Web spider.
Oh.
That's the famous spider.
Oh, I didn't
spider.
Know
yes.
that.
Yeah, that's
right. if that's the right one, and it's got that, we call it a zipper spider because it's got that Z in the web.
Yeah. Uh-huh. One of the interesting unsolved questions of spider behavior is, what is that Z for? One theory is that it's a courtesy to birds, it being no advantage to the bird or the spider to have it crash into the web and you can see it. However, it does have also that special silk has ultraviolet reflections. It may help to attract insects. Maybe, who knows, maybe it's just done for the fun of decoration.
All right, Sally, did you have a question about catnip?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Is it a good idea to feed my healthy indoor cats fresh catnip I'm growing?
I would say not a problem. They love it. In fact, a lot of times the cats will go roll in a bit of it and just they get high on it, really. That's basically what happens. But they love it. It should not, if the cat wants some, I'd say yes.
Oh, that's wonderful, okay. Because I have been feeding it to the boys and was unsure. I thought, oh, I better check. But this is a protected plant that I grow in a pot in
okay.
a protected area, because my other catnip I was growing outside, the outdoor cat would eat it so down to the dirt.
Exactly.
This plant never had a chance.
It's addictive. It absolutely is. They like it, though.
All right, Sally, thanks for your call today on Creature Comforts. My quick story about catnip, we had a kitten once around Christmas time. We gave it some catnip. By the end of the day, it was crawling up the Christmas tree, so we decided that was probably the last time it got catnip. We're on Creature Comforts, going to take a final break of the hour. Still time for you to call in with a question about spiders or a pet question this morning. Call us 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464. Back after this.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.
Welcome back to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell, here with Libby Hartfield, the director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science, Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and John Davis, a museum volunteer and retired science educator who's giving us just some interesting and fascinating things about spiders this morning. Call us if you have a question, 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464. We had a caller earlier who was not able to stay on the line but was wondering if cedar was effective in repelling spiders.
Well, again, getting back to the matter of house hygiene, cedar can keep insects away. And the spider is there not because it wants to invade your house, but because it wants a nice, safe place with insects that will eventually go away. They're not there.
All right. Let's go to Tupelo for our next call. Jason's on the line. Jason, go ahead.
Oh, I've got a question for Mr. Davis.
Okay.
I've got a little bit of a cleanup situation. We're getting our house ready to sell, and the house has been built on a slope. So we've got a conventional foundation. There's about a 5-foot crawl space there that we have used to store everything we never needed. Old rolled up rugs, just odd and ends, you know.
You
that
could
sort
really
of thing.
Have a problem with widows there.
And well, I went to clean this up the other day to get all this stuff out. I mean, loose boards, cardboard boxes, everything. And there were just webs and, you know, visible spiders and that sort of thing. And earlier in your broadcast, I noticed that you were saying that insecticides were ineffective, you know, and yeah, I'm going to have to get this stuff out one way or another, but I had seen advertised some of these sonic devices that are supposed to run insects and spiders off. I don't know if that's a gimmick or not. But
unfortunately, that is a gimmick. It doesn't work. But now you have one of the unusual and extreme cases where a chemical blitz might work. For your house, for day-to-day, for ordinary household work, no. But in a scorched earth case like this, where you might very well have – this is precisely the sort of low, dark place where you might find all three of our widow spiders, the southern black widow, the northern black widow, and the brown widow. I would go ahead with some – powerful pesticide in this particular case, being, of course, very, very careful to use the stuff. It's dangerous itself.
There you go. Is this something that, like a one treatment thing? Or, yeah. I mean, you know, should I just go back and, you know, do this for a couple of weeks and then, that would be that. I'm just kind of dreading it, just to be honest with you.
You are a very wise man. Wear gloves. Wear gloves. Almost everyone bitten by black widow spiders today is doing precisely what you're doing, or around a woodpile. In the bad old days, of course, of outhouses, that's how people were. It was embarrassing, bitten by black widow spiders. But the point is, we're not qualified to really talk about chemical pest control. Go to a reputable exterminator and discuss this matter, and it may be a blitzkrieg situation that would be justified, but day-to-day, chemicals don't work well.
All right, Jason, appreciate your call on Creature Comforts. I think we have time for one final call of this hour. Let's go to Folsom, Louisiana. Mark's on the line. Mark, go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I work with some children in the elementary school. We enjoy nature, and we've been seeing a little green spider. Most of the time I see him, he's kind of low in some bushes. Usually with he's usually upturned, upside down, predominantly green, but he has some orange, beautiful colors, really orange and yellow down the lower part of his abdomen. And I was wondering, I'd love to be able to tell the kids what kind of spider that is.
That is the so-called orchard spider.
Orchard?
If you'd like to look it up, the generic name is Leucage, L-E-U-C-A-G-E. It makes a type of web called a sheet web in which it hangs upside down.
Right.
Belongs to the family Linopheidae. You are right. Like many spiders, it has an extremely delicate beauty. So I think you'll find You'll find it on the web under those names.
Orchard spider.
Uh-huh. L-E-U-C-A-G-E.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for interesting the children. That's wonderful.
Thanks for the call, Mark. We've got a couple minutes left here, and I still wanted to get to some of John's questions that he sent in advance of his visit today. This one, what spiders got their name from a raunchy Italian dance?
Well, around the Italian town of Taranto in the 18th century, working folks would get together at night, drink a little vino, and start dancing. And the authorities eventually took a dim view of this. So the dancers would say, look, there's this big old spider that hangs around here, and if it bites you, you get sick and you have these spasms and you dance around. And the dance, by the way, from Taranto was called the Tarantella. All of you Godfather fans heard it a couple of times in that series. Well, turned out that this is a wolf spider, but when tropical explorers in the New World found these big old hairy spiders, they thought of Taranto and the Tarantella, and guess what they called them? Tarantulas.
How big are tarantulas usually?
Well, our tarantulas look like humongous, but a very large spider is a couple of inches. In South America, there are some species that may have a span of 6 inches or so. As far as North American tarantulas are concerned, the greatest danger is that they can throw some of the spines on their bodies like porcupine quills.
Wow.
And if you don't never approach a pet tarantula from directly behind, you might get a face full of tarantula quills. Ours are not particularly venomous, but there are some tropical forms that you might use to bite James Bond movies.
All right, let's talk a little bit about webs, because I had asked a question before we came on the air today, and you gave me what I thought was kind of a surprising answer. The other morning, I'd seen some spider webs when I came in. It was I think it was yesterday when it was so foggy. They're really very nice, detailed, and quite large, but when I went out at lunch, they were gone. And you said that sometimes the spiders eat their own webs.
Many spiders do their spinning at night. And in the daytime, they may actually recycle the protein. You think spiders make amazing use of silk. And then put out the web again at night. So webs may appear and disappear that way, yes.
All right, we've got only about a minute left, and I've been very patient, but I have to mention before we go that Gilligan's Island did have an episode that featured spiders. It was a giant spider, actually, and also involved a homing pigeon. It turned out that the I can't remember the exact scene, but like the homing pigeon scared the spider away. It was like a huge spider in one of the caves on the island, and the castaways didn't know what to do. But the homing pigeon actually saved the day on that episode. And also Sherwood Schwartz, who created Gilligan's Island, also created the Brady Bunch. And there's a famous episode on the Brady Bunch where I think they go to Hawaii, and there's a scene there where a tarantula, I believe, gets in bed with one of the children there. So Sherwood Schwartz apparently had some interest in spiders. As we close down this show, a reminder that tonight at 7 on MPB Radio and Television, a special Southern Remedy, it's a question and answer and panel discussion about swine flu. So again, that's tonight at 7, MPB Radio and Television. Get your questions answered about swine flu, hosted by our very own Dr. Rick DeShazo. And Libby, just quickly, would want to remention that on Halloween, a special thing at the museum starting at 10.
Yes. Oh, I've got a tick in my throat there. Slither, crawl, fly, 10 to noon on Halloween Day.
That's right. So it's a chance to learn about the creepy crawlies that we so much get frightened of on around Halloween time. And as you mentioned, kids can bring the costume. Should be fun for all. 10 to noon this Saturday, Halloween at the museum, Slither, Crawl, Fly. Creature Comforts is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. Funding provided in part by the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science Foundation, the Foundation for Public Broadcasting in Mississippi, and listeners like you. For Libby Hartfield and Dr. Troy Major, I'd like to thank our guest, John Davis, and ask you to join Felder Rushing tomorrow at 9 for the Gestalt Gardener, and be sure to be here next Thursday at 9 for another Creature Comforts right here on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.